from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After 20 tumultuous months, the 9/11 Commission today released its final report. At nearly 600 pages, the document points to profound national shortcomings in the run-up to September 11, 2001. Here's how Chairman Thomas Kane described those failings at this morning's press conference.
We did not grasp the magnitude of a threat that had been gathering over a considerable period of time. As we detail in our report, this was a failure of policy, management, capability, and above all, a failure of imagination.
Responsibility was laid at the feet of a wide range of government agencies today, from the high-profile FBI and CIA to the lesser-known NORAD, or North American Aerospace Defense Command, and more. Both the Bush and the Clinton administrations got a share of the blame. America's institutions and leadership, said the commission, failed in ways large, small, and disastrous. Emphasizing the gravity of the findings, Chairman Kane urged the country to respond quickly, saying, "We do not have the luxury of time. We must prepare and we must act." Tonight on Point, the 9/11 Commission's final assessment of how America failed to stop September 11th. We begin in Washington, where Washington Post managing editor Steve Call has been following the commission since its inception. Good evening and welcome, Steve Call.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Steve, is this the report that the commission was expected to deliver?
I think in many ways, yes. It's comprehensive. It's well organized. It's a narrative of the events that it was asked to investigate that is unusually rich in detail. And yet at the same time, it is organized by a broad vision of the major themes, and you heard Tom Kane outline many of those. And finally, it does what the commission was asked to do, which is to recommend specific changes designed to prevent such an attack from recurring.
567 pages and a lot of controversy at the genesis of this commission. And even throughout, what has most struck you, having followed their work throughout, having seen the staff reports that have emerged over recent months, when you look at the whole document, what's the message here?
Well, total failure, but across many more areas of national policy than is typically highlighted in the media coverage of institutions like the FBI and the CIA. I think that what this document argues and presents really is failure of not just management and bureaucracy and individuals within those bureaucracies, but also a failure of national eyesight and a failure of American foreign policy over two decades. And I do think that's what the history suggests. That's important in assessing the future as well, because if the United States learns from September 11th only that it needs to turn the dials of its bureaucratic organization or improve the management flow of communication, it's unlikely to prevail over the challenges that it now faces.
And Steve, we heard Chairman Kane there pinning the fault ultimately on a failure of imagination. That's a huge kind of indictment, but at the same time, diffuse. Did the commission wimp out in pinning blame and pinning accountability on specific people and agencies?
I mean, I think that's a fair question, but I actually don't think so. I think by failure of imagination, he describes the truth, which is that even the best informed analysts and officers inside the National Security Council or at the CIA or the FBI lacked the ability to imagine that bin Laden could pull off the attack that he carried out on September 11th. It's not so much a diffuse failure of imagination as a specific one. The United States was outthought by Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who imagined how to turn hijacked American civilian airliners into cruise missiles, and in doing so also saw their way through all of the vulnerabilities in our defenses.
The families of victims of 9/11 pushed very hard for this commission and have stayed on top of it all the way through. Does it look like the kind of document they were looking for? Is there satisfaction here?
Well, I think the families are a diverse group, and so it's difficult to generalize about them. But there will certainly be some among them who will be disappointed by the very issue that you just asked about. There are certainly some who have been pushing for a much more direct sort of inspector general's kind of accountability about individuals and institutions. And their pressure has been an important part of the process. It's led to perhaps more pointed evaluations of that kind than would otherwise have taken place. Others will be satisfied that the commission has laid bare many more secret facts about the conduct of U.S. foreign and intelligence policy than I can remember any commission of its kind laying bare since certainly the 1970s.
And Steve, finally, what about the momentum behind this report? Does it feel like it's got a big head of steam? Does it feel like it will in fact be an engine capable of driving reform, rethinking, reassessment in Washington?
You know, I'm not certain that it will be that kind of a catalyst. It will certainly contribute to a broader discussion that's ongoing about structural reform in the bureaucracy, the creation of new institutions, new positions. But that debate is going to have to wait almost certainly until after the presidential election in November. And by the time the next president, whoever that is, and the next Congress come back to these issues, the report will be 6 months on the shelf, and it'll be an important document, but perhaps not catalytic.
Having to wait, even as the report itself warns of more and even bigger attacks in the future.
Well, that's an interesting comment that Bob Kerry, one of the commissioners, made today. He, talking about reform, he said that he wasn't himself optimistic that substantial reform would be enacted before the next terrorist attack. He thought that it would be the next attack that was truly catalytic, not the commission's work.
There's a terrible warning. Steve Quall, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Glad to be with you.
Steve Quall is managing editor of The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Washington.
We recognize, as commissioners, that we have the benefit of hindsight. And since the plotters were flexible and resourceful, we cannot know whether any single step or series of steps would have defeated them. What we can say with a good deal of confidence is that none of the measures adopted by the United States government before 9/11 disturbed or even delayed the progress of the Al-Qaeda plot.
Chairman Thomas Kane speaking earlier today at the 9/11 Commission's press conference. We are talking tonight about the failings highlighted in that commission's final report. What do we know today that we did not understand 34 months ago in the rubble of 9/11? Has the 9/11 Commission got to the heart of the matter? How could the massive plot of 19 terrorists on American soil unfold undisturbed and undelayed by America's vast security apparatus? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is John Diamond, intelligence reporter for USA Today. He's been following the commission's investigations. John Diamond, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good to be here.
Also with us tonight from Warrenton, Virginia, is John McGaffin, a 31-year veteran of the CIA who served as station chief at five Middle East locations and retired as associate deputy director for operations. McGaffin also served for 6 years in the FBI, where he was senior advisor to Director Louis Freeh and responsible for long-range enhancement of CIA-FBI relationships. We'll be interested in that tonight. Good evening and welcome, John McGaffin.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
So here we are, and I just have to put it to you first, John McGaffin. It is still stunning to hear those words, the plot of the terrorists going ahead, not disturbed or even delayed by the United States government in all its glory. It's still an astonishing thought, is it not, as we sit here tonight?
I think it's not only an astonishing thought, it's a devastating thought, and we are clearly with the work of this commission at a crossroads where we can accept the fact that it was a systemic failure of major proportion, or we can work at the edges, at the margins, and not make change. But it is indeed astonishing.
We want to dive into the failures that we're here tonight. We're going to look at that and more in the course of this evening. But, John Diamond, on the failure front, help begin to walk us in here. How imagination is a very big word, and we understand that at the top level. But beneath that, what was the commission primarily pointing to today? Can you characterize the sort of broad silos of failing that are the mainstay of their critique here?
I think a couple of points. When we talk about imagination, one of the things that refers to is the failure to imagine an attack of this specific kind, the use of airplanes in this way, even though a careful view of the terrorist threat record would show not many, but some examples of this kind of thing. The incident in Paris I believe it was in the early 1990s, the plot to hijack planes from Manila and crash them into the Pacific in the mid-1990s, the crash of a small plane into the White House. But beyond that, you have the specter of the CIA in the 1990s focusing very intently on al-Qaeda and on the issue of terrorism, the threat of terrorism, but not being able to penetrate deep enough to uncover what was going on here. The closest they came was in January of 2000, where the National Security Agency intercepts of conversations about this meeting in Kuala Lumpur, which it turns out later, of course, two of the hijackers attended. This was a very important coordinating mission for this attack. Even to this day, however, U.S. intelligence has never been able to fully sort out what occurred at that meeting. And what happened was that once the meeting was under surveillance, the participants then scattered, and the U.S. intelligence lost the trail. It's not until August of 2001, just a couple of weeks before the attacks, that U.S. intelligence realizes and notifies the FBI that these two hijackers, of course, that they're not known at that point as hijackers, but that these two people who are known members of al-Qaeda are in the United States. And so that just proved to be not enough time to track them down and break this plot open.
John McGaffin, if I may turn to you, we're going to look at the big pillars of the critique of failures here, but it's some of these smaller things that just make your teeth ache when you think that if only at one of these points, and they outlined 10 of them here, the terrorists might have been snagged, this might have been broken, it might have, never mind the systemic issues, they're there, but there might have been specific steps that could have thrown this off the rails. When you look at that list of 10 operational failures as they're described, what most makes your heart quaver?
It's the seam, if you will, to use the basketball metaphor, between domestic and foreign, between the CIA and the FBI. It's the inability to cross over between intelligence and law enforcement, the same seam that allowed a lot of this to happen.
And so no discovering false statements on visa applications, not recognizing manipulated passports, not taking steps to go after these two terrorists who were overheard in Malaysia.
There were separate worlds going ahead. There was a CIA world and an FBI world that tried to come together, but because they had different functionality, wasn't. So that's what allowed the disconnect between the two. I think that this notion of imagination and I think John Diamond hits it right on the head. Well, imagination was a failure in that sense. The real failure was, of course, the ability to penetrate, to have human sources that could deal with this, because the problem with imagination is that there are an infinite number of things that the terrorists can do to us. So to imagine, to anticipate what they could be, is never going to be sufficient.
Jack Beatty, if I may bring you in just a minute before the break here, failure at the highest kind of levels of imagination, but very importantly, as John points out, failure right on the ground.
Right on the ground, and just to give you a global reaction, I think this should be called the Families Report. One of the families said in the paper today that she talked to somebody, a family who had survived the Lockerbie bombing, and that woman said to her, "My gosh, for 13 years we tried to get these doors reinforced in cockpits. We couldn't do it. You've got to succeed where we failed." And this woman who, from the September 11th family, said, "I took that as a sort of moral mandate. We were going to succeed." And at every step of the way, they met obstructions from this administration. To go right back from the beginning, Vice President Cheney called Tom Daschle and warned him not to open the hearings and said, quote, I'm quoting Newsweek, implied he'd be charged with interfering with the war on terror if he did. They wanted to appoint Kissinger, the commission chairman. The New York Times said to contain an investigation. The administration opposed. They opposed granting the two-month extension. They refused to let Rice testify. Only bowed to pressure there.
And yet it finally came out. We're going to look at all these details. Jack Beatty, John McGaffin, John Diamond, stand by. We're talking about how America failed to stop 9/11. This is On Point.
07.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the 9/11 Commission's final assessment of what went wrong in the run-up to 9/11. You can join our conversation tonight. Has the 9/11 Commission got to the heart of the matter? How could the massive plot of 19 terrorists unfold, as they said, undisturbed and undelayed by America's vast security apparatus? And are you surprised even now at the breadth and depth of the U.S. security failures? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chairman of the Commission, Thomas Kane, talked today about responsibility.
Our failures took place over many years and administrations. There's no single individual who is responsible for our failures. Yet individuals and institutions cannot be absolved of responsibility. Any person in a senior position within our government during this time bears some element of responsibility for our government's actions.
Thomas Kane today outlining responsibility and talking about the failure in all its magnitude. We're joined tonight by John McGaffin, a longtime CIA officer, five-time station chief in the Middle East, and a former senior advisor to the director of the FBI, Louis Freeh, joining us from near Washington. Also from Washington, John Diamond, the USA's intelligence reporter, and our own Jack Beatty. John Diamond, let me come back to you, if I may. The report, in the executive summary we've been looking over here today, we haven't got to all 500-plus pages yet, but it walks right through a series of major categories in which they found severe problems. And some of them are still particularly interesting to look at. For example, lack of military options. You've covered the Pentagon as well. What are they pointing to when they talk about lack of military options?
There was a... The military was not set up, not trained and equipped, really, to fight sort of small-scale, hit-and-run style operations against small terror cells. You remember in 1998, you had the cruise missile strike on the camps in Afghanistan,
right,
and on the pharmaceutical plant in Sudan. It turned out that the pharmaceutical plant was a bad target. Terrorists, if they're going to be fought, really need to be fought on the ground. There were no existing options for getting into Afghanistan, a landlocked country.
Because the U.S. military didn't have the capacity to pull off that kind of operation?
Not so much the capacity. I think there were huge diplomatic barriers at that time, prior to 9/11, to launching that sort of offensive operation. Condoleezza Rice has talked about that. But the options were few. The equipment really, you know, the United States military is really equipped for major land and air battle, not sort of battling small groups who are hidden away. I think that another major failure that I see here, especially having coming off covering the Iraq intelligence issues.
Yes.
There's a coincidence in this report. They talk about how the plot first is hatched by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in conversations back in 1995. Well, the CIA had not done a national intelligence estimate going back from 1995 all through September 11, 2001, on terrorism. That's a six-year period where they hadn't taken
the critical all of, 6 years.
Yeah, the same six-year period when this plot was being hatched, the CIA was failing to sort of step back. Let's talk to all of our intel agencies, get them all together in a room, and say, what are we seeing about the terrorist threat? They didn't do it. Same thing with Iraq. The CIA had to be asked and prodded by Congress 3 weeks before, about a month before the vote on war in Iraq. Hey, give us a national intelligence estimate on the WMD in Iraq. So that to me is inexplicable.
John McGuffin, take us into the CIA here. They've been punched around all over the block in recent weeks, and we get mixed messages out of the CIA. Some saying at certain levels the CIA was acutely almost crazed with concern about what was going on with bin Laden, and yet not reporting that out, not coordinating with the FBI. How do you see the critique today in this commission's report of the CIA?
You've raised a host of issues. On the issue did the CIA and in its counterterrorism work understand the magnitude of the threat posed by al-Qaeda and bin Laden, absolutely. They had established an al-Qaeda station, the entity with which you pursue a target that worked with the FBI and worked across the world with foreign liaison services, knowing full well that this was a problem. And the proof of that would be in after the East African bombing, the African bombings, when very quickly, as you recall, we knew that it was an al-Qaeda activity. It wasn't because al-Qaeda took credit, but rather because we had built up such a knowledge of the organization, al-Qaeda, that we were able to see as people traveled in and out in the wake of that, that they did it.
Then why not the document John Diamond is asking about here from 1995 to 2001? Why not the big report that would really shake the bars on the cage?
I think that is a significant problem. More
is it a political problem?
I think, well, that's where I'm getting. I don't think it's a political problem putting out the report, but the political problem, to my understanding, is the one of at the point that the knowledge in the CIA and DOD and other places reached the extent that this was an acute problem, the administration was unwilling to accept some of the proposals for more direct action against bin Laden in Afghanistan on the basis of political considerations and said, yeah, there's not sufficient actionable intelligence.
And you're talking the Clinton administration in this case.
I am indeed. And the charge that, you know, the shorthand in the world I live in was, well, what if the Little Sisters of the Poor are in the motorcade accompanying bin Laden? And you can put off an infinite number of proposals saying, well, what if the Little Sisters of the Poor are there? I think there's a very substantiated argument that many proposals were made for direct action leading to it and were put off for political reasons.
Jack Beatty, there's a finger on failure pointing at the Clinton administration. Both Clinton and Bush administrations came in for critique today, and a clear balancing act in this equally politically balanced commission, really not to weight the bulk of the failing on either administration.
Yes, I don't think they could have had a unanimous report if they had done otherwise, and they're really trying to say, well, here's a model of national unity. But at some level, of course, they've had to sacrifice a certain trenchant quality to the report. And I think some of the families will surface that. But, you know, Mr. McGovern, talk about President Clinton. But let's look at the imaginations of some of the key actors in the Bush administration. After all, failure of imaginations means some people's imagination. Mm. Consider the National Security Advisor, Rice. By everything to read about her, her entire outlook on life had to do with states, the problems of states, states' threats, China, all the rest of this. And Richard Clark, in his testimony, said just trying to get her attention for this notion that there were transnational actors out there who could do us terrible damage. This was he went on and on about the trouble of getting her attention. Take the Attorney General, Mr. Ashcroft, in the spring of in April 2001, Louis Free talked to him about terrorism, and he said, you know, we've got to do something about the terrorism portfolio. And according to Newsweek, again, Ashcroft, quote, didn't want to hear about it. Then later on, the acting director of the FBI, after Mr. Free retired, Mr. Picard, he was briefing Mr. Ashcroft on these matters, and according to his, he briefed him a couple of times, and according to Picard, Ashcroft said, I don't want to hear about that again. Ashcroft's focus was on what? Well, crime and prostitution and drugs and other matters, but I don't want to hear about it again. Well, you have to say, suppose he had had suppose he had said, tell me all you know. Would that have made a difference? And finally, the president, you know, I mean, he has not taken responsibility for this. I guess that's too much to hope for, although Prime Minister Blair did for the intelligence failures attached to their commitment to Iraq. And, you know, one of the striking things about Mr. Bush is, one, he knows himself and he's very confident of his own, the rightness of his opinions. That's a great strength. On the other side, that's a weakness. He's not an intellectually curious man. Even his friends would admit that. If he had been more curious, if he had asked the third and fourth and fifth questions, would the trees have been shaken all up and down the government? We will never know.
Well, certainly a lot that an intellect could dig its teeth into in this big report and everything that's going on here. What a challenge to the security apparatus of the country and to the future. Let's turn to our callers. Paul's calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great, thanks.
We can talk all we want in one way or another, prior administration, current administration,
yep.
about how much of a commitment and awareness we had. But in my opinion, the real issue is the progenitor of the failure of imagination, which to me is the failure of character and integrity, is the result of a superpower sense of invincibility from being the only superpower on the planet, from winning the Cold War, with a sense of arrogance that made us even turn a blind eye to, for example, the penetration of Al-Qaeda affiliates even back in 1990, according to John Miller, the ABC news journalist, in the book The Cell, in the assassination of Mayor Kahane, there was a player, El-Sayed Nasser, who was directly connected to players in the World Trade Center. And if the World Trade Center, it wasn't a wake-up call, I don't know what was.
So, Paul, you're pointing the finger at everybody, at all Americans' attitude? Is it really that broad?
I do believe so, yes. Unfortunately, we have to all be accountable in one way or another. We elect our officials become arrogant. Pride goeth before the fall. The failure of imagination is the result of the failure of character and integrity, where we feel we're number one.
We've got it. Let me put that to John McGaffin. John, when you sat in the CIA and FBI, was there ever this kind of conversation, you know, there are things that need to be done, but the American people just aren't up for it, and we can't outstrip our country?
I have to disagree with the caller, Paul. I think the indictment may be worse in the sense that it wasn't the arrogance of we know better and we don't have to do it. It was a failure to do the things that intelligence, both domestic collection for the FBI and foreign for the CIA and the NSA and others, ought to have done. We didn't have the ability to push through to follow up on the recognition that this was a problem, to penetrate those organizations one way or the other.
And did,
it wasn't
did
that we
you...
didn't know it, it's we just didn't. We didn't, for a variety of reasons, push through to get the job done.
Did you know? Did you know that you didn't have the capacity, John McGaffin, as you sat there?
On the one hand, you'll have my colleagues from the CIA and elsewhere saying, well, you know, the Congress cut our budget. True, the Congress cut our people. The Congress put restrictions on what we can do. That's all true. And you know, when we should later turn our discussion to the Congress and its role here. Having said that, the question that we don't turn our attention to is, did we use those assets that we still had, cut or not, as aggressively and as focused as we should on the real problems of penetration of hostile people who do us harm? And I'm afraid the answer is we did not do it as aggressively as we should have.
John Diamond, I hear you there.
Tom, I think there was also a belief that while terrorism was a threat worldwide, I think there was something of a sense of arrogance that terrorists did not have the global reach to come to the United States and do this kind of damage. All the pre-9/11 predictions tended to focus on major attacks overseas. And you asked earlier, what do we know now that we didn't know at the beginning of this process?
Yeah.
One of the really interesting things that comes out from reading the body of this report, you remember right after 9/11, there was talk about sleeper cells. That was a big buzz term, these
yes.
cells that get into a country, get into the United States, disappear for a while, and then spring out and launch an attack. While that is true, one of the things that the report points out that was central to this plot was mobility. The plotters, the 19 hijackers, the people that were supporting them, were flying all over the world for the year before 9/11. They were going from the Mideast to Asia, from Asia to the United States. A tremendous mobility. No one was stopping them anywhere.
And the government, the commission says today, not expanding no-fly lists during that time.
That's right. They weren't. The U.S. intelligence was not set up well to follow individuals, and it tended to play, in the words of one of the witnesses during the commission, a zone defense, where once somebody of concern got out of, say, the Asia zone, the people responsible for that zone simply dropped the ball. And these people were traveling all over, and they were very skillful at forged passports, and we just weren't set up to track that.
And we're not trailing them. Delta's calling from Methuen. Hi, Delta. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a little disappointed with the commission because they talked a lot about the failure to think outside the box, and yet the commissioners themselves have done this because they stayed within the box of how do we defend against terrorism, but they never addressed the root causes. They never brought up a topic that they had a perfect opportunity to talk about because they have in a bipartisan commission of people who are not up for election, and they have the attention of the whole nation, and they could have sat down and said, okay, why is it that these people hate us so much? Why is it that they're willing to die by the hundreds to fly airplanes into our buildings in order to kill us. What is that we've done to make them so angry?
Well, Delta, I don't know. Let us pick that up. I'm not so sure that they didn't touch that at all. John Diamond, can you speak to that? There was a lot of attention paid in the recommendations here to the necessity of reaching out to the Middle East, of engaging in a battle of ideas, not just military and intelligence with the Middle East, with raising new opportunities for the Islamic world. What do you think of Delta's criticism?
No question. They raise failure of diplomacy in terms of a better relationship between the United States and that part of the world. They talk about such things, for example, as the mistreatment of prisoners in the Iraq War, as an example of the kind of thing that's detrimental to the U.S. image and that can aggravate and foment this kind of attack. At the same time, when you read the narrative of how this attack unfolded, it was you don't hear Khalid Sheikh Mohammed complaining about policy X or U.S. position Y, other than the general opposition to U.S. support for Israel. It's really the idea that the United States represents something that they are against and is a large target, that attacking a large, powerful target will enhance their reputation in their world, that the United States is a supporter of the Saudi royal family, that sort of thing. It's not so much a point-by-point policy critique that you hear coming from al-Qaeda.
Jack Beatty, what about it? Do you still hear, as our caller Delta does, a lack of imagination even in the commission's big final report?
Well, they certainly don't. They at least in the summary, I see, they just sort of go over the surface of it. Historical resentments owing to European colonialism, and then American policy in the region, and then cultural issues with, modernity versus fundamentalism and so on. But they don't go into it very extensively. Perhaps in the narrative they do. It's the picture of Saudi Arabia that I think there's more to be said there, that they just don't do. In fact, at one point in the report, they say, we don't know. Finally, we don't know where this funding came from. And
they absolve the Saudi government effectively.
I guess so, but I'm still worried about that, and I'm worried about the 26 pages that are missing, redacted in the Senate Intelligence Report on all this, and they also have to do with Saudi Arabia. And I guess my thought is what they're describing partly as the reason Bin Laden attacked us is essentially the Wahhabist faith of Saudi Arabia. When you really break it down, it's that radical Islamic outlook that is, in fact, the state religion, state-sponsored religion of that ally of ours. And I don't know, and I guess here I'm agreeing with Delta, I don't think they make enough of that here.
But really understanding, really imagining what that means is a big effort of imagination, maybe remaining to be done. We're talking tonight about the 9/11 Commission's final assessment of what went wrong in the run-up to 9/11. You can join the conversation tonight. What about accountability? Should heads roll, even now, and whose? And has the 9/11 Commission earned its keep? Was it tough enough, fair enough, thorough enough? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. John Diamond, thanks for being with us tonight. Great to having you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about how America failed to stop 9/11, what we've learned from the big final report of the 9/11 Commission. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you imagine now that the very creation of the commission was itself controversial, that President Bush opposed it? Have we got to the bottom of the failures of 9/11? Do you believe, as Chairman Kaine said today, that we are safer now than on 9/11? And finally, does the American imagination now understand, really and truly understand, the gravity of the threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here's Chairman Tom Kaine today on the ongoing threat.
Because al-Qaeda represents an ideology, not a finite group of people, we should not expect the danger to recede greatly as years to come. No matter whom we kill or capture, including Osama bin Laden himself, there will be still those who plot against us. Bin Laden has inspired affiliates and imitators. The societies they prey on are vulnerable, the terrorist ideology is potent, and the means for inflicting harm are readily available. We cannot let our guard down.
Chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Kane, earlier today. We're joined tonight from Warrenton, Virginia, by John McGaffin, longtime CIA officer and former senior advisor to the director of the FBI, Louis Freeh. Our own Jack Beattie is with us, and now from Washington, James Bamford joins us. He's an investigative journalist, writes frequently for the New York Times Magazine and the Washington Post Magazine. He's author of A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, and Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency. Good evening and welcome, James Bamford.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. I'm sure you listened with very close attention today to the Commission's critique, particularly their critique of the failings of the U.S. intelligence world. What did you make of it? Did they get it right? Have they got it?
Well, they got part of it. They identified a lot of errors that the CIA and the FBI committed in the run-up to the attacks, and I think they covered the ground pretty well. I think the area that they missed is the area that one of the callers called in about, and that's the whole issue of U.S. foreign policy. It is very specific why they are attacking us. There's been a number of fatwas that bin Laden has issued saying exactly why they're attacking us. It has to do with our policy in the Middle East. And I think the answer that we're giving is that we're invading another country in the Middle East, Iraq, based on very little reason. So I think the end result is we're going to have more terrorists and more incidents, and that is the part of the problem that I don't think was addressed.
And when you say policy in the Middle East, do you mean Israel? Do you mean oil? Do you mean backing authoritarian governments?
Well, it's a little bit of all of that, but it's primarily our political relationship with Israel. We're backing Ariel Sharon, and he's using our helicopters and our bullets and our money to attack the Palestinians. That creates enormous amount of hatred throughout the Middle East. So the Bush administration has done virtually nothing to try to bring an end to that conflict, and he's aggravated it by basically caving in every single time that Ariel Sharon does something.
I think that's
one of the key things that the administration has to start focusing on if they want to prevent the attacks in the future.
And as the country looks to revamp the intelligence agencies, give us your back-of-the-hand calculation about what went wrong with our enormous intelligence agencies on 9/11, with all that we've learned, with what we saw, with what we see in this report today.
Well, I think a number of things went wrong. One of the things that you hadn't talked about yet was the lack of risk taking by the CIA, and that was a major problem, I think, with trying to penetrate Al Qaeda. The CIA had long had the attitude that it was too dangerous and it was too difficult to try to penetrate Al Qaeda. On numerous occasions, officials would say that the organization was too close-knit, that it was too dangerous to put CIA people in there, so they resorted to using the Pakistani intelligence or hiring a group of mujahideen in Afghanistan with very little supervision. And as a result, there was nobody was ever able to penetrate al-Qaeda. Yet at the same time, in the summer of 2002, there were eight Americans, native-born Americans, who actually did enroll in al-Qaeda.
And voluntarily, on their own volition.
On their own volition, and had one-on-one meetings with bin Laden at at his training camp in Afghanistan.
Which is to say, it should not have been impossible, you're saying.
Exactly. John Walker Lynn was one of those people, and he did exactly what I would have thought the CIA would have done, which was to take somebody, have them study the Koran, have them learn Arabic, send them to one of those madrasas in Pakistan and one of the religious schools, go to a mujahideen training camp, and then using a letter of recommendation went into Afghanistan and was accepted into al-Qaeda.
John McGaffin, let me ask you, does the CIA today have the courage? Is it over the risk aversion that blocked it doing that before? Would it do it now?
The risk aversion, you've got to distinguish between there clearly, as we saw in the Afghan to run up to the Afghan war, there are plenty of very brave, courageous people in CIA who take the risk and go live in Afghanistan with Massoud, fight and die, and so it's not risk aversion in that sense. But I think Mr. Bamford's got it just right. It's a risk aversion of a broader sense of a bureaucratic sense of how do we proceed. I think that on the one hand, this notion of, well, they use liaison, they use Pakistani.
Right.
That's not an appropriate thing. Of course, you would use those people who have better access because they are Islamic and who are friends.
But half of them are practically in bed with Al Qaeda, Pakistan's intelligence world.
Well, I didn't say that Pakistan intelligence. You would use Pakistanis and others to get to what I'm saying is sending a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant into.
You don't need to do that necessarily.
It's probably a stupid thing to do. Having said that, I mean, $40 billion a year is the intelligence budget, and to have penetrations of Al Qaeda at that level is what you're supposed to do. And that's to me is the most powerful condemnation that we didn't get there. So that's like Bamford's right.
We're talking about failures leading up to 9/11 tonight, as outlined today in the 9/11 Commission's report. Paul is calling from Mount Vernon, New Hampshire. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for airing me.
Sure.
I think that the woman that spoke about Middle East policy is right on the point. The Palestinians have dreams too, and to some degree we have to facilitate their achievement of those dreams. Otherwise, this is all for naught. With specific respect to the using of commercial aircraft as weapons, I think some of our CIA people need to take a vacation and read a book. I think they've got to read Tom Clancy's Dead of Honor,
which was on
the bestseller list for years. And it's a book about a disgruntled Japanese airline pilot who crashes a fuel-laden aircraft into Congress.
And down comes the Capitol building.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in terms of imagination,
there's a lot of it. I mean, Clancy, what, Sum of All Fears? He's got a nuclear device at the Super Bowl, as I recall.
Exactly. This is the sequel. And, I think some people, it must be too bureaucratic or something. They just have to read some books.
Paul, we've got it. Let me pick that up with James Bamford. James, what about it? A failure of imagination, but there it is in hardback, paperback, bestseller. I mean, it's not that hard to imagine, but maybe the commission meant something else?
No, I mean, you don't have to go to Tom Clancy. All you have to do is go to the Central Intelligence Agency. They had a report there from the FBI. They had reports there from the person who blew up the World Trade Center the first time, Ramzi Youssef, when they raided his apartment in Pakistan in the Philippines, and they found his computer. One of the things they found on the computer was a plan to blow 11 aircraft up simultaneously over the Pacific, and then a secondary plan was to hijack an American commercial passenger jet and crash it into the Central Intelligence Agency.
So what does that does that suggest then, James Bamford, that it's not exactly a failure of imagination, that in itself is a kind of dodge, that people could well imagine it but didn't want to do the hard work that responding would require?
Well, that's it. It's just they had the information there, the potential there. It's just that it got pushed aside and put on a bottom drawer or something, and nobody really paid much attention to it until after the attack. Now, the problem with just on a larger picture here, the problem with this commission report and all the focus on this today is that we're focusing on one area basically, and that's the attack on the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon with the aircraft. There's a thousand scenarios you could come up with in terms of blowing up a bridge over in the Midwest with a train with 100 passenger cars on it. I mean, there's all kinds of scenarios you could come up with. So the alternative is not to try to think of every possible scenario, because you'll turn the country into a police state. It's the callers, which seem to have more intelligence than a lot of people in Washington. You have to come up with a way to resolve the problems that are creating the terrorism.
And as John McGaffin says, you can imagine anything, but go out and find what's actually being planned and go after it. Jim is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot. My question is sort of an extension of some of the points that were brought up earlier about the root causes.
Yes.
Which I think are critical. I mean, of the things that I forget, I don't know who your guest was that sort of affirmed that, but Israel was mentioned, our relationship with Israel was of the many things that these fatwas are issued on is something we know that we have to sort of change. In addition, you know, relationship to the Saudis, maybe energy conservation here at home. If you had to look at all of those potential solutions, you know, we need to find the optimal mix that works to make the country safer. What sort of a model can we use to prioritize relationships that we have that might be old and important, but how important in the larger scheme of things?
Well, that's interesting, Jim. Thanks for the call. John McGaffin, how about it if the U.S. set out to review its policies and priorities in the Middle East, top to bottom, oil dependence, the works, what kind of priority scheme would you put up against that?
I think that the most important part of that is an extension of what the earlier caller said about, are they angry about Israeli policy? Are they angry about the Palestinian Israelis? Are they angry, as some would say, about bin Laden's angry about American troops near Mecca and Medina? I don't think that we've gone far enough in understanding that and in fact fall short. I think the anger is much worse and much more fundamental, and it goes to a notion of what I call the existential battle, which is the fact that the people that fly airplanes into building don't do it to teach us a lesson. They do it for a positive reason, this small portion of Islam, that says to do this is to end American cultural hegemony that prohibits us from going towards the success, the full fulfillment of Islam. That's the issue we're up against. And even if you were to remove the troops and solve the issue of Israel, of Palestinian-Israeli issues, you do all those, you would still be left with a group of fundamentalist Islamic people who believe that as long as we continue to dominate the airwaves and the cultural waves, that they can't proceed. That's going to be with us, and it's much more dangerous.
But they're not protesting Coca-Cola. They're not protesting McDonald's. They're protesting U.S. Military involvement in the Middle East.
Read what Bin Laden said.
It's very specific, and it's right there. Jack Beatty, we've just got a minute left. This is coming to an interesting point, and right around this issue of failure imagination, the kind of suggestion that there may still be a failure of imagination. Even in this report today, someone in our conversation tonight said one that may take yet another punishing attack to jolt us into figuring out.
Well,
yeah,
if it's true,
the answer is to figure out why they're attacking us and they're not attacking Canada or Sweden or Switzerland or some other place. Maybe it's our foreign policy.
No.
They all have freedoms. They all have Western culture and Western values. The difference is they're not supporting one country occupying another country, the Palestinians. They're not occupying parts of Saudi Arabia.
And all teamed up with Saudi Arabia. Jack Beatty, what do you say?
Well, you know, I think the most poignant sentence in the entire document I've seen is one that gets right to this question of hearts and minds. It says, define the message and stand as an example of moral leadership in the world. And think of that in connection with Abu Ghraib. The damage this intervention, this scandal, this Iraq has done precisely to these long-term questions of why do they hate us? What can we do to stop them from this perpetuating unto the generations?
Many failures. We're going to have to look at options to change all that, and we will do that. Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And James Bamford, author of A Pretext for War, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And John McGaffin, former CIA officer and advisor to the FBI's Louis Freeh, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure indeed.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.